Scorsese, your time's done. Move on, let others move in. De Niro, ditto. DiCaprio, threefold.
What's up with Hang? That's so vague.
It's not the right question.
People are absolutely getting wasted off this homebrew. It just goes to show that Travis isn't the only spirit of interest.
Well, Danvers gets around quite a bit, so she might be related to everyone in Ennis.
She's also rolled up a massive fat spliff that she's making her way through. She's high as fuck.
This podcast was recorded remotely and may contain adult language and themes.
Hello and welcome to TV DNA True Detective Night Country Episode 2. My name is Adam Henning and I've been joined by the Barry White of TV DNA. It's Mr. Neil Shepek.
Howdy.
And our very own Spice Boy, Damian Cooper.
Wrong question. Ask again.
Yeah, we're going to come on to questions later on in the pod, but I just referencing there the many brilliant needle drops. Apologies if you can hear lots of applause in the background. That's not for my introduction. I'm at the space and there is a show just finishing. But yeah, amazing needle drops in this episode particularly, I thought.
How can you not enjoy Spice Girls?
Quite. Before we get into this episode, though, chaps, there are, and we should say, because I failed to say this last time round, there will be spoilers ahead for True Detective Night Country. This is not a watch this episode. We are going into spoilers. So if you haven't yet watched that show, pause this podcast, go and watch it, because it's brilliant, and then come back and listen to us fools. But I had a few thoughts on episode one. While I was editing, actually, the podcast, things were occurring to me about the first episode. One of those is that Ange, her full name is Evangeline, and she's quite evangelical in her pursuit of solving Annie's case. Second thing, did the scientists write "We are all dead" on the whiteboard, or was that something or someone else? And my third thought was she hates the Beatles because the Beatles were on the radio when the road accident happened. That's a theory.
All of those are interesting. As far as writing on the board, I mean, there was one geologist who seemed to be taken over in some way. I think it's the same geologist who ended up taking clothes off and running out into the snow. So I wonder whether it's him writing, although it might physically be him writing, it might be this kind of supernatural element.
Yeah, what I would also say that I think backs up your theory, Adam, is whilst it isn't a medical doctorate, they are all doctors. And that handwriting is far too legible for them to have written.
By the way, Clark is the geologist who was found walking around naked in the snow and who was the one that we saw in episode one who clearly was possessed in some way.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he's still alive, isn't he? We find that out, like, you know, massive spoiler here. Like, at the end of the episode, we find out that Clark is the only one of the scientists not in that big popsicle thing.
Yeah.
So he's somewhere still out there.
And who knows what we'll find out about Clark.
Sorry, there's lots of noise here. The audience, we've got a big audience in the space tonight. They're all just leaving the venue, so it's quite noisy. Let's get into episode two then. I thought this was incredible, gripping stuff again. I was particularly gripped by the sight of Christopher Eccleston's buttocks.
I wasn't, but I did think his accent was pretty impressive, actually. And I didn't recognise him to start off with, even though I'd read previously that he was in the series. I thought his acting was fantastic and his buttocks.
Yeah, I enjoyed that depiction of middle-aged sex. And I also enjoyed that Liz Danvers is completely insatiable.
Yeah, I made the note that, yeah, Danvers gets about a bit, right? Because there's a whole scene with her talking to a teacher and that she basically dismisses all of his pupils. And he's like, look, we talked about this. You can't just come into the school demanding sex from me. So clearly she's done that in the past. Is that what it's like at your school, Neil?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Should we go back to the beginning then and deal with this in some semblance of order? Or is there anything particularly about this episode that drew your attention, that you particularly liked?
I put it in the WhatsApp group because I absolutely lost my mind when it happened. We have another significant connection to season one. We've already talked about the Yellow King. We've now got the Tuttles being mentioned, which we'll obviously get to, but that's very exciting.
The symbol as well, right? The symbol, swirly symbol, big focus of this episode, was also tattooed on the first victim, I believe, in series one.
Yeah, there's a connection there, and that is really exciting to see how that plays out. I was grasped right at the beginning of this episode with when they take the hand off and the body screams. That was something that I thought was just awesome TV.
Yeah, it was like classic horror stuff, right? So they're taking photos of all the frozen corpses. We learned that they've got burnt corneas, ruptured eardrums. They're all naked. There's a tattoo on the forehead. Someone scratched their own eye out. All of these different weird things about these bodies. It's essentially a shit bowl.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, so we've got that post-death. I can't remember what the term is when people suddenly move after they've died. But obviously, the same thing happened with the wolf that was being gutted open. We've seen it a couple of times now. Some sort of post-death animation, for want of a better phrase. But the other thing that was so arresting for me was that the rest of the police were fucking idiots. Like, it was unbelievable how unprofessional they were.
Well, if they were hideous, it's a good job they weren't naked.
It's a big part of this is whether or not Danvers should be taking the case, right? They talk about giving it to Anchorage. She says, fuck Anchorage, we're taking it. And then Chris Freckleston's character comes in, Connolly, I think his name is, and he's like, no, we're going to give this to Anchorage. And she's like, no, you're not. There's kind of pointers towards the fact that she's not actually that good at her job, that she's accused of not giving a shit or not doing anything by various characters, I guess, in the show. But yeah, they're fucking around. One of them breaks off an arm, and then this frozen guy starts screaming. After the credits, we find out he's in an induced coma. They may have to amputate a leg. I predict that he'll wake up somewhere around the final episode.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And then they move all these corpse ghouls to the ice rink to defrost over, what, 2 days, I think they say?
Yes, indeed, they do. I enjoyed the Christmas song that was playing. It was almost, you know, we get in the home counties, we get the sort of Father Christmas on a truck coming around visiting places.
Like the Coca-Cola truck.
Yeah. Usually raising money for, a good cause. Anyway, it reminded me of that, the fact that this truck was coming along. It was like some sort of Christmas celebration, except it was obviously underneath the tarpaulin were these 7 frozen scientists. But yeah, I really think they used the music in a really good way. And that was a good, really and good, obviously excellent words for someone like me to use.
We've kind of skipped over some stuff before the corpsicles are there. We meet Kate, who is played by Dervla Cohen, who is part of the family that own the mine, and they basically own the whole town. And so that is their team. The ice hockey team is kind of the local social focal point. And it turns out that Liz Danvers has also fucked Kate's husband.
Yeah, we get mention of Kate McKittrick in the first episode. She's mine people is who she is. Again, Danvers' history, like she may have had an affair with Kate's husband, and that's why there's some tension between the two of them in that scene.
I'd say it was very frosty between them both.
Should we stick with Danvers? Because I think she is a fascinating character. Not we mentioned last week that she wasn't entirely likable. Like, her treatment of Navarro wasn't great. I think her treatment of Pete Pryor, her deputy, is also really not brilliant, because she's ultimately fucking bullying him.
Yeah.
Good chat.
I had nothing to add to that. You're right. She's problematic as fuck.
So she's accused of not doing that, not doing anything. I mean, ultimately, is she the Woody Harrelson of this series, right? Like, he wasn't.
Yeah.
He totally had his faults, didn't he, in that first season? Do we like that about Liz Danvers as a character? Is that something that we appreciate, or is it certainly more interesting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I do like it. I like interesting, complex characters. I think it's great. And Jodie Foster is absolutely fantastic as an actress generally. But also in this, you don't know whether to side with her or not, which means that you end up kind of questioning decisions that she's made as a character. And I think that makes for really good drama.
Yeah, I think also just the fact that she's a woman is that extra layer to that. Is that what matrix are we marking her on? We took Woody Harrelson's character in season 1 to be shall we say, I don't want to say problematic, but yeah, not the best cop in the world, shall we say, not the best detective there ever was. I believe the term is stretch goals for him in terms of his work. But yeah, how do we then put that on Liz? I agree. I think she's a really interesting character. And I think just that scene she has with Evangelina, talking about how she behaves with Pete, where she says to Evangelina, I'm not working with you again. And Evangelina says, no one wants to work with you except that poor boy, and you'll break his heart soon. So, like, it's known that she's a pain in the ass. It's probably because she's also a dynamite lay that she's still on the job, so to speak.
Yeah, we saw her on the job at least once this episode. I think it is interesting how Eccleston's character, he wants to take the case away from her and she's refusing that, slightly using the fact that they have sex as a kind of leverage. But what do you think? Do you think she should still be on this case? Obviously, it's very dramatic, but, you know, what's the moral stance on this?
I don't know. She'd already said fuck Anchorage right at the beginning of the episode before Eccleston arrived, right? So, but that could well have been fuck Anchorage because of him. So he basically says, you're only taking this case to fuck with me. And that could well be accurate, right? My feeling is she's going to get so drawn into the case, it's going to, you know, have a bigger impact on her as a character.
It's really hard not to have a tinfoil hat at this point. But I do think that part of that is that he is like definitely, well, he's significantly higher up in the pecking order, isn't he? Which means he probably has been told you have to keep the mining family fairly sweet. You can't upset the status quo, because if that company leaves that mine, Ennis is a ghost town and nothing happens again there. So I don't know if part of that also him taking it to Anchorage means that he can control it more easily, and that the powers that be stay the powers that be, relatively unchecked. The conspiracy can continue.
It's interesting that you call Ennis a ghost town, because there's a couple of references in this episode to the fact that people in Ennis are quite used to seeing dead people. Dead do speak in Ennis. There's lots of references to the place being a special or a different place to normal. And beyond the fact that obviously they have night for however many months, you know, continuous night. What did you think of all of that stuff?
I thought visually it was really, I guess, beautiful. I thought the cinematography is generally been fantastic in these first two episodes.
Yeah, I agree. My worry is if there's all sorts of weird supernatural bullshit, because the rest of this show has been, whilst pushing the limit, has still very much existed in the real world. I don't want to see little hairy aliens or anything like that. I want things that are maybe not easy to explain, but still explainable.
And we've got a little bit of that with the Fiona Shaw scene, right? So Fiona Shaw, who plays Rose, has a conversation with Navarro, and they have a relationship because Navarro was the one who found Travis. Travis, who we get confirmation was Travis Cole, was Rusty's dad. He basically walked out into the ice because he had leukemia and wanted to control the way that he died. She says, death didn't change him. The fucker only comes when he wants something. And she says stuff like, you know, seeing the dead happens a lot in Ennis. She also says, don't confuse the spirit world with mental health issues.
But don't forget, she's also rolled up a massive fat spliff that she's making her way through. And then she says something that sounds like the kind of thing that would be heard in undergraduate rooms all over the world. I think the world is getting old, and Ennis is where the fabric of all things is coming apart at the seams. She's high as fuck.
She probably is, but she also says that with all the various ghosts that people see, some miss you, some have something to say, and some try to take you with them, and you've got to work out why you're witnessing them.
Yeah, it's really lovely stuff. There's talk about the symbol at this point as well, and she says it's older than Ennis, older than the ice, probably. Just pause here to talk about the symbol and what it means, and about the Tuttles, because I think that all right links into it. But the Tuttles were behind this sort of paedophile ring that existed within the first season of the show, and this symbol has something to do with them, right?
Yeah, and another reason why I think that Connolly is trying to take the case to Anchorage to control it is that in season one, Sheriff Tuttle tries to set up his own task force to take the job off Rusty Cole and his partner. And so not only is it Sheriff Tuttle, but I think also Reverend Tuttle, who is the head of that kind of slightly strange Gothic church. That, yeah, but yeah, they are part of the Yellow King conspiracy of some pretty horrendous. Well, I think it is, yeah, mostly paedophiles, but there are also generally just young women who aren't children that are also sadly full foul of that conspiracy.
And we should say that also, just to tie this all in, is that Liz had asked Pete to look into who funded the Salau research station. And he finds out that it's Tuttle United and that they are, you know, they're involved in all of these different things from glass and all sorts of other stuff. But they are the ones who funded this research station. And the other thing that we learn from the teacher that Danvers used to fuck is that the scientists have spent decades trying to sequence the DNA of an extinct microorganism that potentially could stop cellular decay.
Why don't you try an English, nerd? Yeah, and so the thing is also, just to quickly add on that Tuttle thing, so he's had to trace it. So it's the science research lab is funded by an NGO, which is then linked to NC Global Strategies. So a kind of classic nonsense doesn't mean anything, which is then owned by Tuttle United. So the conspiracy is very deep.
So, yeah, my understanding, just to sum things up, and please say if you have a different understanding, is that what the geologists and scientists were exploring was a way of either preventing or curing cancer and other degenerative diseases.
Yeah, and crucially, the teacher's like, you know, this ice coring stuff that they were doing was never going to work. He also talked about the fact that they were madmen and reclusive, that they didn't rotate the crews. So it was always the same eight guys there the whole time, whereas other research stations, they would kind of have time in there and then time out of there and that sort of thing. So they were quite obsessive, committed to what they were doing and not taking any time out of that.
Or maybe they weren't allowing the opportunity for someone else to see what they were doing.
Yeah.
Nice. Where should we go next?
We find out that also, just quickly, that Evangeline's sister has the gift too. And so we said before about, in the first episode, there being a call put out that she was saying there was definitely someone in her home. And obviously Evangeline tries to calm her down, but obviously it's not the first time this has happened. And Rose says, I think Rose explicitly mentions that Evangelina's sister also sees dead people. So we've got a little bit more confirmation that it's not just that she suffers from depression or PTSD, but she is also communing with spirits.
Let's talk about Navarro a bit, because we get there's some really nice callbacks literally to the first episode of this series, the previous episode. Navarro comes into the bar and she's like bachelor later at her sister. We know they like to chill whilst watching The Bachelor. And then we get this lovely, again, the exchange of Evangeline Kavik, like the way that they acknowledge each other by using their full names, I think is really nice.
Yeah. And in that scene, we also see something else. We see a fight breaking out between the mining guys and the ordinary people who live there, because it turns out that the mine has been polluting water that the villagers use. And kids are starting to get sick. So a guy starts a fight with one of the miners who is, I believe that's the miner that has seen the picture of the scientist, unless I'm jumping to a different scene. Or is this the same one?
Say it again.
So Evangelina comes into the bar and she sees some of the miners that are there. And so she wants to speak to the brother of the girl that was murdered and shows him the picture of the scientist and says, do you know this fella? And he's like, I don't know. And then someone else, one of the other miners comes up to him and says, what are you doing? Leave her alone. And then he looks at the photo and then looks like he knows who it is. And when his question says, I don't know. And then after that, that's when there's a fight between the villagers and the miners.
Yeah, it's Chuck Mosley. He basically sees the picture. She can see that he recognises the guy. And later on, she goes and finds out that he bought a trailer off this guy's cousin. He gave him the money in cash about 7 years ago. But yeah, he's a mine dude. And I think the interesting thing in their later exchange is when she says, you didn't like Annie, you're okay with what happened to her. But yeah, he's not a nice guy, Chuck Mosley. But obviously the trailer is kind of key for her then later on working out where they might leave a trailer, where they might hide a trailer, and kind of what was going on. Because it turns out that this Clark dude was in a relationship with Annie. They've got he got his tattoo because she already had that tattoo on her. We also learned through various investigations, I can't remember whose, but that he got that tattoo shortly before she died.
Yeah.
One of the other things that we see is Evangelina is also that we hear once again more about Eddie's homebrew. That obviously this place technically isn't a bar. It doesn't have a liquor license, but people are absolutely getting wasted off this homebrew. And it just goes to show that Travis isn't the only spirit of interest.
Very good. We get the video of the scientists doing karaoke to Barry White. And a lot of conjecture about what happened to them. Sudden drop in pressure can damage eardrums. I really loved all of this. What's the right question stuff? You're not asking the right question. I thought it was a really genius moment of tying in her working with Pete and actually that he's quite capable and intelligent. And then also the sort of later on we get Navarro saying, hang on a minute, what's the right question? And actually the good side of what Danvers does is she's that investigative mind and how she inspires others to sort of do that as well.
Yeah, I think what is also interesting, I think is either that scene or just after the wrong question ask again between Peter and Danvers is that he has the phone at one point. So these corpuscles are slowly defrosting throughout the episode. And at one point he gets the phone and he goes up to the corpuscle and he puts it right up to the face of the corpuscle. And Danvers is like, whoa, what are you doing? Obviously used to the unbelievably unprofessional behavior, thinking he's going to snap off a finger or whatever. But he manages to use face recognition to unlock the phone. And that's where we get those videos. And it's interesting that we have that moment where, because he has a better idea of technology, she is becoming the student as much as he is the student with her. But needless to say, looking after the corpuscles, it's a long fucking night. Even the dead guy gets bored.
It's two fucking long nights.
This was for me, like, again, this was Danvers' absolute peak dick, right? She's made him miss his son's bath time, pissed off his wife, who's... Yeah, and by the way, she's got to go and pick up her daughter from their house so that she can go home and untangle the fucking Christmas lights and put the Christmas tree up.
Yeah, I mean, that conversation they have. So Kayla says, you're taking my man again. And Danvers says, I'm actually doing you a favor. Soon you'll not want him around. Kayla says, save your favors for your own family, right? And that was pretty pointed. And then that is when she goes around the corner and sees her daughter having some First Nation tattoos done and massively overreacts, which I think is the whole do you save your favours for your family is what really kicks it off. And I think that kind of shows really what's going on in the power play between these two women.
Would it be fair to say she's an anti-hero or heroine?
Absolutely. I think so. My question was... And I don't think it is. Are they in some way related? Are they cousins? Why is there such a close bond? Or is it just because it seems that Danvers is not only has some level of rapport with Kayla, but also with Kayla's mum. So I don't know if it's just small town business or whether they're cousins or there's some kind of familial bond. Obviously not Danvers because she's from somewhere else. But I think within the community there.
Well, Danvers gets around quite a bit, so she might be related to everyone in Ennis, but I think it's probably more small town bonds.
Shall we talk about, I guess, one of the most upsetting scenes, whilst we're talking about Pete and how he's been badly treated, one of the most upsetting scenes was Hank kind of backhanding him, having discovered that Pete had stolen the files. It was a pretty horrible moment, I think, in the show. I guess it's a little bit, I'm a little bit mollified by the fact that Hank is clearly being catfished by this fiance that he's expecting to come over for Christmas.
Yeah, I don't think Alina is real because, yeah, it's all text, isn't it? And it's all really manipulative text that she's sending him. Is it a scam to get more money? But also this talk of picks, is it not about that? Is it about leverage? Is this something from the mining family or someone else? Because obviously Hank is ruled by his penis. And so he's easily manipulated, for want of a better phrase. And so that's a good way of making sure that whatever happens, he's kept on side. Because they go, well, actually, well, we've got all these pictures you've sent of yourself pleasuring yourself or doing other stupid things.
Touching back on the topic of Liz's reaction to the sort of face painting that's going on with Leah and Kayla's grandma, right? She's drawn Kakanit. Apologies if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, on Leah's face, which is the three lines that go down her chin. And I did a little bit of research into this, and that these often represent the three stages of a woman's life. So you've got the maiden, the mother, and the crone. And kind of all three are present in that scene. You've got the young girl, a couple of mothers, in fact, and then the grandmother in there as well. And I just loved the fact that she called her a laundromat grandma.
Man, that was so harsh. I think that's interesting because we are very much also seeing her as sexually awake, right? So obviously she recorded that sex tape in the first episode. She's gone off to meet this other girl, possibly the same girl from the ice rink in the shop for goodness knows what sort of stuff. But just quickly also, Hank, as you were saying before about this idea that Hank, that there is a history of that violence. Hank says, blood is blood, Peter. Remember that. And the other thing he says is, you stole those files from me. Your mother may have left us, but she never took anything from us.
But the other thing he says is, Danvers doesn't own you. It's all really fascinating stuff, I think. There's a memory of a child that Danvers has, which I assume is Holden, the name that she sort of called out in the previous episode. And again, this is inspired by the polar bear toy. And he says, I'm the one eye, which I think backs up my theory that this polar bear is a local legend, the one eye polar bear. We assume it's something to do with a road traffic accident, right? And that's where this child is, you know, the child is no longer with us. We know that. And maybe that's why she stays in Ennis, because she doesn't hear the dead and wants to.
Oh, nice.
We haven't seen Liz with Rose yet, have we? I mean, surely that is something that's going to come up.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other thoughts then? Well, how does the episode end? Oh, this is a big thing, right? They find the trailer.
Before that, I just want to quickly, I know we briefly touched on Danvers and Connolly hooking up, but I think the things that we definitely saw was that Danvers did not take her thick socks off at any point. And we also found out that even though they've both been married in the interim, they have been hooking up for 19 years.
And Danvers says, this is the last time we do this. Do we believe that?
No way.
This was the second time in two episodes that we had a bloke basically saying, stop, stop, and the woman making them continue. I just point that out. No judgment.
What is your point?
I don't have one. But yeah, but this episode ends with, well, they find the trailer. Navarro finds the trailer. They work out where we should hide a trailer. How did he keep it a secret is the right question for Navarro. And so she finds it, and it's full of all of these very, very, again, very reminiscent of season one, sort of animal bones, decorations. There's drawings on the wall.
And the drawings of the symbol as well.
Yeah, so just in between that, because I think it's important that it's in that order, is obviously, as you said, Danvers and Navarro have decided to unite. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's all the same case. Cool, let's begrudgingly put things aside and become a duo again. But we cut back to the ice rink, and Peter is there watching the corkscrew slowly melt. Leah turns up, and then we get that line, that sticks with you, not being good enough, which I think is something, obviously, that we'll be dealing with later on. But he finishes that. And as he says that, we hear a cracking noise as the bodies have thawed. So as we get more and more of the narrative, the bodies slowly thaw. And then we have this, right, something significant has happened in the thawing of these bodies. And then we cut to finding out where the nook is and them going to the nook.
Yeah, the other bit, going back even further on this, is that the conversation between Liz and Navarro, basically she finds the photo that she gets from the tattoo artist that shows that Annie and Clark knew each other. She also at the same time gets the results that it's Annie's tongue that was at Salal. And so she's basically goes to Navarro's place, breaks in and waits for her to come back, and then starts putting away her shopping, which was like just such a weird apology. Like, I'm going to help you put away your shopping because I'm sorry and I need you to work with me on this now because you know the most about Annie. So that's kind of what's bringing the two of them together. But also, Navarro then tries to talk about the Wheeler thing, which is obviously something from their past. And Liz just shuts that down pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think it's the next scene where Danvers is looking through the scientist notes and there's all sorts of weird things. There's all these circles. It's the same pattern pretty much repeated over and over again. And I wondered if that was some kind of gravitational pull or something, yeah, gravity-based. But in amongst all these squiggles and words, you can clearly see in much bigger writing, oh God, full stop, never sleep.
Yeah. Great stuff. So, yeah, the episode essentially ends with them discovering that Clark's not there. He's alive. He's out there.
So. But also, there's a corpse there. So, any thoughts on who the corpse is?
In the trailer?
Yeah.
I thought that was a doll. I didn't think that was a body. I thought that was, like, I had to go back and watch it again. But I'm pretty sure that that was, like, there were various different constructs and things that had been built and made, and I felt that that was potentially some like akin to perhaps a voodoo doll, essentially, that it was a body that had been created to represent someone else. A
large voodoo doll, yeah. Or maybe Clark positioned a doll or a real life corpse for people to think it's him, although we know it's not him.
And then as soon as they see that body, Liz gets a little over the radiator, you can tell it's cold, over the radio saying, Chief, we have a problem. And that's obviously the whatever's happened, that crack that we've heard back in the ice rink.
That's Clark not being there, right? They've only got six bodies.
He's alive. He's out there.
Speaking of out there, we had a game, didn't we, last episode, where we predicted how many of 10 questions would be answered within the following episode. I think, Neil, you said none of them. Damo, you said 3.5, and I said 1. I've got 3 that I want to talk about fairly quickly, but one of the questions was, how did Travis die, and why can Rose see him? And I feel like that was answered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
One of the questions was, what's up with Hank? And I feel like it's a half for me. Like, we learnt some background on Hank and why he is the way that he is.
I don't think that question is specific enough to have a decent answer. What's up with Hank? That's so vague.
It's not the right question.
Lovely stuff. We can only go with the questions that were asked last week, right? I mean, we can table amendments to the question if you'd like going forward. But for the parameters of last week, I think that's a half point. So currently, that's 2.5 points, yeah?
1.5. So the third one that I'm talking about is what happened in Liz's past? And why is she Leah's mum? And I think I don't know that I can necessarily call that a half. I think we got some of Liz's past, but I just wanted to bring it up as I thought, you know, if you want to argue for that as a half as well, you can.
If you want to about being Leah's mum, I think that's fair enough. So we've got more information there. But as far as what do we learn about Leah's past, again, it's just such a vague question.
I think we should meet in the middle and just say that's a half then.
In that case, we've got two... Basically, I'm ruling out any of the other questions as being answered because I don't think any of them were. So that's 2 questions answered, a total of 2, which means that I was 1.5 away. No, I was 1 away, and Damien, you were 1.5 away. So I think I get half a point for last week.
This is what I actually meant to ask at the time, and I should have done now. But once it goes beyond the threshold of what your guess is, surely it's null and void.
Fair enough. So what we're saying is you don't score unless you get it dead on.
I repeat, I will re-look at the questions and how easy it is to get them dead on. Because, yeah, I do think they're a little vague. Like, what do you learn about Liz's past? I mean, her past is what, 40, 50 years? I mean, what's her past?
Let's pick no more than 6 questions for the next episode, right?
Right.
10 was a lot. We're already going fairly long. But we need to really think about what are the right questions. So my suggestion is, where is Clark?
Yeah, okay, I'll go with that. That can be specific.
Will we hear Tuttle mentioned again?
Yeah, I'll have to go with that. I'm pretty confident that it will be.
But we're saying for the next episode, right? We're not saying for the whole of the series. We're saying
in the next episode.
Yeah, fine.
The questions that are raised by the show, right?
These are quantifiable.
My other suggestion is, what did Navarro do wrong / what is the Wheeler thing?
I think that's two questions.
All right, I'll go with what is the Wheeler thing.
I've got one. Will we see more of Alina's scam?
Okay, I think that's specific if there's a development in that part of the storyline. Yeah.
The big questions we've got from the show, how did the scientists end up on ice?
Yeah.
And who killed Annie?
Yeah.
All right, that gives us six questions then.
Damo, how many of the six questions do you think will be answered?
I'm going to stick with roughly that amount, but I'm not going to go for halves. If we're going to get rid of halves, as much as I enjoy them, let's drop a half. And I will say, out of the six, three.
Cool. Just on the halves, because we all love a competition, these questions are now being much more specific. So there shouldn't be any halves involved. It's either yes or no. For me, I'm going to say two.
Great. Well, I'm going to stick with my one then, because I think that's, the most likely scenario. That's True Detective pretty much done. Unless there's any other final thoughts or anything else you wanted to bring up about that show?
No.
So the Oscar nominations happened this week. It would be good to get a bit of reaction and thoughts on that. We will be, certainly I know that Neil will be, and I'm planning on watching as many as I can, but we'll be making our Oscars predictions again this year. But yeah, let's get some initial reaction on the Oscar nominations.
I definitely echo the sentiment that Greta and Margot were both huge influences and parts of the Barbie film. I wasn't a fan of the Barbie film, so it probably won't be in any of my predictions, but it does feel unfair, to be honest.
Yeah, it's the big sort of furore after the nominations essentially was that Ryan Gosling's been nominated as Best Supporting Actor, yet Margot Robbie's not been nominated as Best Actress for Barbie, and Greta Gerwig has not been nominated for Director for Barbie. And I watched them live, actually. I was off on the day the nominations came out, and they were broadcast live on ITV. So I watched Zazie Beetz and your man from The Boys making the announcements of who was nominated. And before they came on, somebody from the Oscars came on and explained how the nominations are made, in that the members of the Academy all vote within their own categories. So it is actors voting for the acting categories, directors voting for the directing categories. They all vote for Best Picture, but that's essentially how it works. Like, in terms of an Oscar snub for being nominated, it's not like a sinister group of people hiding in a room making these decisions. It's a vast number of people who are peers of those people who are being nominated, who are voting and making those decisions. So I think it is unfortunate that Margot and Greta weren't nominated in their categories. I think it's a little bit of a disservice to those people who were nominated in those categories. But ultimately, the issue is that Best Supporting Actor is a less competitive category than Best Actress, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really strong year for films. I've seen about a handful of them already. And to have Barbie nominated as one of the best pictures and not to have the director nominated, and then, as you say, to have the best supporting actor nominated but not the best actress nominated, who kind of leaves the film. For those who are fans of the film, she's done an absolutely amazing job. But it is what it is. Democracy, is it?
Yeah, it's a very limited democracy. In a kind of classic Athenian sense of democracy, those with power can vote, and your average farmer doesn't have a fucking chance. In that respect, it is, yes, very much pure democracy. I think some other interesting omissions in the big, quote-unquote, big categories. Saltburn, nowhere to be found, really, which is, I would have put money on it being there. Although, as I said previously, I didn't particularly enjoy it. I thought Barry Keoghan and Rosamund Pike were very good. And then the other thing, having seen Killers of the Flower Moon, old Robert De Niro definitely deserves his best supporting actor nom. It was interesting that Leo, however, has not been nominated, even though the film, the director has. But having watched it, I kind of get it. He is good, but I don't think he goes toe-to-toe with Cillian Murphy in Oppenheimer or anything like that. So, those are the kind of standout things for me, on top of the Barbie stuff, obviously.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm 2.5 hours into Flowers of the Killer Moon. And in the back of my head, whilst I'm watching this film, I'm like, Dame said it gets good. And I'm like, just wondering, at what hour does it get good? Because I'm really fucking struggling to care about anybody in this film because it's so fucking long.
So, Adam, are you just kind of like popping back to the cinema every couple of days to watch a bit more?
No, Neil, because this is on Apple TV Plus.
Adam TV Plus.
And normally I'm a big fan of anything on that. So I was like, well, the first of the Oscar-nominated films I'm going to watch is the one on Apple TV Plus. But my goodness, I mean, to be fair, I haven't had the time to sit down and watch a big chunk of it. But whenever I've watched it, I've struggled to stay engaged with it. And I think it's, I'll be out there and say, I think Scorsese, your time's done. Move on, let others move in. De Niro, ditto. DiCaprio, threefold.
I think DiCaprio has still got more in him.
Not in this film.
No, maybe not in this film. And I haven't watched this one yet.
What I will say is I disagree a little bit on Bobby De Niro. I think he is actually very good in it. I think the problem with Leonardo DiCaprio is that you never really know where he lands on the big conspiracy that goes on throughout the film. I think that is the issue, the thing that I felt a little bit cheated by towards the end. But you cannot fault Lily Gladstone as Molly Burkhart. She is brilliant.
Yeah, and the only reason that I was watching it, I am being a little bit harsh, and it is a large part of it is the fact that I haven't been able to watch a good chunk of it all at once. But it's much, much longer than it needs to be. Doesn't need to be 3.5 hours long as a film at all, I don't think.
I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon, but obviously Lily Gladstone is nominated for Best Actress in a Leading Role. I'm going to go and see Poor Things tomorrow at the cinema. But I will say Carey Mulligan, who's nominated for Lead Actress in Maestro, is stunning in it. She's really, really good.
Anything else? You've already seen some of these, Damo. I know you've seen Naiad. Anything else you want to pick out from here?
Naiad. I'll put it out there. Annette Bening and Jodie Foster are really good. When I watched the film, I wasn't so sure about it, as I've been reminded by Raluca when I tell people to watch it. She was like, well, you didn't enjoy it when we watched it. And I think that is true to an extent. But having had time away from it afterwards, there's no doubt that Annette Bening and Jodie Foster are both brilliant throughout, and so are the rest of the cast. I just need a bit more space to appreciate the actual content of the narrative rather than the performances. But that's available on Netflix, has been for ages. It's not 3.5 hours long. But, you know, we've already waxed lyrical about Jodie. See her do more great stuff whilst with the equally fantastic Annette Bening.
So just out of interest, I haven't watched Naiad yet, and now I know it's on Netflix, I will make some time over the weekend. Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress, why do you think it's not been nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay?
Good question. Is it about two middle-aged women, and is that the reason why? I mean, that is absolutely a reason why in those very male-dominated sections... Yeah. You would find that something as it's not nuanced because they're both white American middle-aged women. So, I mean, that story is told often enough, but it's not like, I can't really explain it. It's not like a big action film. It's not like, oh, I can't believe, wow, this is happening. That's happening. Whoa, what's just happened? Wow, it's happening so quickly. It's really measured. It's really well-paced. It's about a woman confronting this almost impossible task. And Jodie Foster is supporting her.
There are over 300 films that are up for consideration. There's only 10 that make it into the Best Picture category, and then only 5 for each of the others, right? So we cover the Best Picture, all of the acting categories, Best Director and the writing ones, right? And last year that meant we had to watch 17 films. This year it's only 14. There's only 14 films covers all of that. So all of those creative nominations, there's only four additional films other than the ones that were voted for Best Picture. Just to quickly add as well, so Rustin, Colman Domingo has been nominated as Best Actor for Rustin. That's also available now on Netflix, as is Maestro. I know you've seen that, Neil. And May, December, that's available on Sky Cinema and Now TV. May, December had a nomination for Best Original Screenplay.
And I think the other significant bit about that is that both Domingo and America Ferrera are the first two Latino and Latina people to have been nominated for an Oscar. I believe that's also significant.
Let's just cover quickly some of the other films and where you can watch them. So obviously Barbie and Oppenheimer have been nominated in the Best Picture category, as well as other categories. Those are both available on Prime or paid for subscription services, as well as Anatomy of a Fall and Past Lives. Currently out in the cinema, I know Matty went to see The Holdovers at the cinema and really enjoyed that. I'm quite looking forward to seeing that one. And Four Things you're going to see tomorrow, Neil. The 26th of January, which is tomorrow at the time of recording, is when The Color Purple will hit the cinema. And then on the 2nd of February, American Fiction and The Zone of Interest will both be released in the cinema. So that's kind of where you can see all of the different films that have been nominated.
I have watched Maestro, I have watched Oppenheimer, watched Barbie. They're the main pictures, but they're also brought up in various actor or supporting role actor or actresses. Oppenheimer, I expect to do amazingly well. The cinematography is amazing in it. The directing is amazing in it. The acting is stunning. I, without having watched the other films in the categories, at the moment, Oppenheimer will swipe the board. Barbie, I wasn't a fan of, and personally, I would not expect it to win any of the major categories. Maestro is very interesting. I think it depends on what your personal interests are. It's a film that covers a really important episode in musicals and music generally, and Leonard Bernstein. I think Bradley Cooper does an amazing job. So at the moment, for best leading actor, I think he'll go to Cillian Murphy, but I'm predicting Bradley Cooper. But I haven't watched Rustin yet, I haven't watched Holdovers, and I haven't watched American Fiction. So no definite predictions yet.
I have heard that Paul Giamatti is in strong contention for best actor.
So where do we see Holdovers?
Go and watch The Holdovers in the cinema. Okay, Grant, thank you so much, chaps. If you want to let us know what you thought of the Oscar nominations or what you're enjoying about True Detective Night Country, you can get in touch via the social media at TVDNAPod on all good platforms, or you can email TVDNAPod@gmail.com as Marjorie did all those many, many months ago. We're going to be back with our Watch This episode fairly soon. We're going to be watching Griselda and talking about everything else we've been watching and what's coming out next week. So join us for that. But in the meantime, goodbye.
My spirit animal showed me in a dream. Remember?
Blood is blood, guys. Remember that.
Hypothermia can cause delirium. A panic, freeze, and voila. Popsicle.
#scissor me timbers. We'll cut that out.